Now, he spent 4 decades behind bars for the murder of 13 women, and this week Peter Sutcliffe died as a result of COVID-19. What lessons, though, if any, can be learned from this tragic case and how it was handled by police and media at the time? Well, I'm joined by Peter Sutcliffe's former therapist in Broadmoor, the journalist and broadcaster Tess Finch-Lee. And Tess, thank you very much for joining us this evening. I understand, obviously, for reasons of doctor-patient confidentiality, you're very limited really in what you can tell us about Peter himself, but insofar as you can talk about him, can you tell us what he was like?
Well, he was an unremarkable man in many ways. He certainly wasn't a criminal mastermind. He was a lorry driver, a grave digger, and a very sick man. And at his trial, I thought it was noteworthy that he himself expressed incredulity that it took so long to catch him. There was a trail of evidence. He was interviewed 9 times and released 9 times. So it's very much my view that he wanted to be caught in many ways. And if the West Yorkshire police hadn't been so blinded by misogyny at the time, I think he could have been apprehended much more quickly and preventing so many needless deaths.
It is a matter of public record that he suffered from schizophrenia, and I'm just wondering to what extent that condition played a part in the context of the whole case.
Yeah, I think that's a sensitive one. It's why I didn't include it in the article that I wrote today, because it's schizophrenia. In fact, mental illness in no way predisposes people in it to violence and in any way. The relevance here is in the context, in terms of him not being a criminal mastermind, that he was ill and in need of treatment and medication, which he did receive when he went to Broadmoor.
Okay. Looking back at the case then, you mentioned that he wasn't a criminal mastermind. This guy wasn't a really, really smart person who was able to evade the police. In your estimation, it was more about how the whole trial was carried out, or rather the investigation. And looking back at the case, one of the things I think that's particularly striking is the way his victims in particular were described in court. You're writing today about how one prosecutor told the trial that some of his victims were prostitutes, but perhaps the saddest part of the case is that some were not. And the last 6 attacks were on, and I quote, totally respectable women. Extraordinary language, really, wasn't it, to be used during the trial?
Yeah, that's one of the things I found extremely shocking, looking through the archives at the time. My involvement with him was, say, 25 years after his crimes were committed. And you'd think, wouldn't you, that kind of language wouldn't exist. And certainly those dehumanising, reductive mugshots and the kind of language that were overtly used in the media and within the police and judiciary at the time are unlikely to be as prevalent today. And yet, in 2018, a barrister, Elizabeth O'Connell, directed the jury in a rape trial to judge a 17-year-old on her underwear in the case. The 27-year-old man was not convicted. And also the Belfast rape trial, where a 19-year-old was subjected to her underwear being held up in court. So I think these cases demonstrate that the misogyny remains, and it remains hardwired in many of our institutions, including the judiciary, and that there's still, even today, a presumption of guilt, and the victim blaming still very much evident there today, which produces an obstacle in accessing justice for many women, and a huge underreporting of rape, which is a serious issue.
Mm.